Welcome to Eric's Perspective. I am in the gallery, M. Hanks Gallery in Fullerton, and joining me today is the successful entrepreneur, art collector, philanthropist, Bob Davidson. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to speak with us and the listeners and viewers of the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Excellent.
You've been a friend for many years, and a person who has been responsible for some of the art that I've been in or to collect. So always a pleasure to be with you.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. And actually, I do want to talk about that. But before we get started, I thought maybe just going back a little bit and talking about you, the beginnings, like when you grew up in Tennessee, as I understand it, your mother had a restaurant, your dad started a bank. Can you talk about growing up in the South?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Middle Tennessee, as you referred to, and both my parents were entrepreneurs, where I get my entrepreneurial spirit. In 1944, my mother founded her own business, a restaurant, and opened a restaurant to serve people in the military because Black soldiers had no place to go. And she opened it, bought all the equipment, and started her business, and ran it there. And the restaurant was there for 30 years.
Wow.
I grew up in the restaurant. My father joined her there, and they became, pillars of the community in Memphis, Tennessee. And so I was real privileged to have them as my parents. My father, who was a consummate businessman, realized that there was no place for Black businesses or individuals to go to a bank to borrow money for an automobile or a car. And, he with some of his friends got together and founded the first and only and still there Black-owned and managed bank in Memphis, Tennessee. It's called Tri-State Bank. Together with both of them, they were pioneers in Memphis and entrepreneurship.
That's very impressive. And you said the bank is still there.
The bank is still there. Tri-State Bank is still there. Yeah, I still own the shares my father had from. He was originally issued, and he turned them over to me before he passed, and I maintained them. I started to turn them over to our sons.
That is awesome. And yeah. What role models? That's so fantastic. You had both parents as role models for your own career as an entrepreneur and so forth.
I was very fortunate. Very fortunate. Yeah.
And you went to Morehouse College and graduated from there. Am I right about that?
Yeah, graduated. I was born, raised in Memphis. I left Memphis to go to Morehouse. Went to Morehouse in 1963. Was there and had a wonderful experience between 63 and 67, right in the middle of the civil rights movement. So I was right in Atlanta doing all the protests and all the sitting in at lunch counters, et cetera. So that was an exciting time to be there as I look back on.
And we should also point out that there's some distinguished alumni like Martin Luther King Jr. himself and Julian Bond and others.
Yeah. But Morehouse has been known for producing leaders. And, we say at Morehouse, you come there to not only get a good education, but learn how to become a leader. Well, you're expected when you graduate Morehouse to go out and make a mark in the world that's doing something for other people. We call it making you a servant leader.
Yeah.
And that's sort of they put that in the water at Morehouse. And you can't, until you learn how to drink that water, you can't get out.
That's fantastic. And then you got your MBA from the University of Chicago.
Yes, I did. I must say, first of all, before I leave Morehouse, I've been fortunate in that we have three sons. All three of our sons went to Morehouse.
Oh, fantastic. All three sons are graduates of Morehouse as well.
All three sons are graduates of Morehouse. So we're a legacy family at Morehouse.
Oh, fantastic. My nephew went to Morehouse as well, by the way, and graduated from there as well.
Okay. Yeah. So that's why, Morehouse runs through the blood here at our house, and then when I finished Morehouse, I went on to University of Chicago to get my MBA. And left there. Went to New York, worked in New York for a while, and then ultimately ended up in Boston, where I was co-founder of a venture capital company that we founded to invest in minority controlled businesses. Oh. Raised in the early 1970s. Our venture capital then is called private equity today, but we raised it. Uh-huh. We raised a pool of money to just invest in minority controlled businesses in the early 70s. That was my first venture and entrepreneurship on my own.
It was
very exciting.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Now, I'm just curious, when you were at University of Chicago, I was a history major in college. I didn't go to University of Chicago, but John Hope Franklin was teaching there. And I remember just feeling very fortunate. I had a project and I chose him as my subject. And I wrote to him, not expecting necessarily to hear back from him. But not only did he reply, but he also sent me essays and things that he had written that weren't really published yet. Yeah. I just felt so lucky about that. I was just curious, were you there at the same time? I know you were in business and he's in history, but I was wondering if your paths crossed.
No, he was there. He was there before me.
Oh, okay.
But his legacy lives on.
Oh, yeah. There.
Of course, you can't go to Washington. I don't know about John Hope Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
And I think as a result of him and others, there is a connection between the University of Chicago and Morehouse.
Oh.
Morehouse tends to be a feeder for University Chicago in various different departments, especially history, sure, and then later on in business.
Yes.
I mean, our youngest son who graduated Morehouse also went to University of Chicago Business School. He just got his MBA from there.
Oh, congratulations to him. Fantastic.
Yeah, so we have a Morehouse Chicago connection that continues to work.
That's awesome.
Continues to work.
So, Bob, talk about a little bit, if you don't mind, your first entrepreneurial venture in Boston. How did that go, and how did you decide to go to Boston?
Well, there were two younger. We were all young at that time. This was early 70s. One fell out of Harvard Law School. One fell out of Harvard Business School. And they had this idea of setting up this investment company to invest in minority-controlled business. And someone put me in connection with them, and I loved the idea. And that's why I went there with them. Went to various institutions around the country where we raised, $10 million specifically to go into existing businesses. No startups, no small businesses, but things that had a track record.
Mm-hmm.
And that went very well. I drew the straw. I was a single one of the three. So I drew the straw of overseeing the business we invested in California, which is how I got to California.
Oh.
So I was responsible for the company in California. And ultimately, one of those portfolio companies, Clarence Avon, was one of the companies we invested in. And Clarence, I would tell him how he should run his business. And he'd say, well, if you're so smart, why don't you come do it? And I'd say, well, Clarence, this is not a job application. I'm just here trying to tell you, because we got an investment, we want to get it done. And as time went on, that was January, and I went back to Boston in the middle of winter. Went back and said, "Well, what a bad discussion." So we were able to pull together a deal, and by spring, I had moved to California to actually run a media company, a record company, music publishing company, and radio station that was owned by Clarence.
After
I got to California. So I had an entrepreneurial experience in terms of raising money for entrepreneurial businesses. And I stepped right into, running an entrepreneurial business for him. And then after doing that for a few years, I said, well, if I can do this for Clarence, I can do it for myself. So I then decided, and we both agreed I would go out and find my own business. So and that's what I did. Looking at business to acquire.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And you ended up with a business, paints and surface coatings and so forth like that, right?
Paint and specialty coatings.
Yeah. Yes.
I've been looking for a business, existing business to acquire, and I looked at a number of them, and they didn't quite, none of them quite worked. And one day I got a call about an existing business, which is a paint manufacturing company. Family owned, it had been around since 1936. And they really wanted to get out of the business. And, I went to look at them, and they were a good company. And the previous owners used to come in at 10, and leave at 2. And I said, just had some, you know, had some real measure to it. It could grow. So
I was able
to negotiate a deal with them, and I acquired my first paint manufacturing company in 1978.
Uh-huh.
And it serves as the foundation for what I did for the next 30 years. And then used that as a platform to buy other paint manufacturing companies. I bought a second group of paint manufacturing companies in 1981. And then I bought another group of paint manufacturing companies in 1988. And I sought to grow those over the following 30 years. And we ultimately became, you know, one of the largest African-American-owned businesses in the country, and clearly the largest American-owned manufacturing company in the state of California. And I had four different paint manufacturing companies under one roof, and we served different specialty markets. Moving TV studio business was one market. Manufacturing business was one market. Automotive repaint was one. And the other was voting for high-profile, large architectural buildings like Staples Center downtown. That's all my pain. Staples Center, or Radio City Music Hall in New York, or Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, or you know, institute places like that were places that used our paint product, our specialty paint product, on their wall.
Fantastic. And I remember seeing it as one of the top 25, as I recall, Black Enterprise named you guys in the top 25 of black-owned businesses. Yeah.
Yeah, we were fortunate, you know, and I did that for, it was a lot of fun doing it for 30 years.
Yeah, that's right. Excellent. And so after you, I'm assuming you sold that business, is that right?
Yes.
And so business-wise, what did you do after that?
Well, while in the business, I had a target. I said, I'm only going to do this for 30 years. And so I started in advance of the 30-year anniversary, you know, selling off pieces and sold the final one right on my target, my 30-year target.
Uh-huh.
Then I decided to turn my attention to doing corporate board service. Uh-huh. So I started serving on corporate boards before I sold the business.
Uh-huh.
And I've been serving on two public company boards, and then I've also spent a lot of time giving back to our community by serving on a number of nonprofit boards as well. I want to focus on children and the underprivileged and for a large period of time. I've been on the board of Morehouse College, board of Arts Center College of Design, Cedar Sinai Hospital, Children's Hospital. On the board of Rebuild LA, things that were involved in making our community better. That I've been very fortunate in my responsibility to share my knowledge and whatever knowledge I gain, experience, you know, with those institutions, make them better. And I served and I remain to serve on these corporate boards to keep my business skills honed and, you know, and because I wasn't retiring in order to sit down and, you know, watch Oprah every day. That was not my goal. Okay,
right.
It was just to move away from that, and you know that you know you need to do something different.
Yes,
and so it was my chance to do something different. And most recently, I've now been serving. I moved to my passion, which is to serve on a number of museum boards. So I'm the vice chair of the board of the Smithsonian Museum of American Art, and I will be the chair of that board in a couple of years. And I'm also on the board of the Hunter Library, and I'm on the collection committee, et cetera. So I'm now indulging my passion with better collecting art by serving with these museum boards. I've previously been on the board of MoCA as well. So I like being on those boards because I can spend their money and enjoy art.
Fantastic. I really admire that, by the way, on both counts. I mean, you giving back to the community the way you have and sharing your expertise and your time and so forth, but also pursuing your passion, which is art, which I obviously now I want to try to jump into. How did you start? Can you trace back when began this idea about collecting art or even you know, going down that path?
Sure. Well, I can tell you this. When I grew up in Memphis, there were no museums for black folks. It wasn't even a day you could go to the museum. I was fortunate. My parents, though, would close their restaurant every year and travel to, you know, Chicago, or New York, D.C., you know, Philadelphia. And, you know, in doing so, they would take me into museums. That's when I began to start to appreciate art in museums. And then while at Morehouse, I required courses out of humanities, and I had no idea what humanities meant. But then I found out it was about art and culture. And that it was the course I enjoyed the most. Anyway, most courses where, you know, it wasn't called study, it was called, you know, just, let me just read more of this in the textbook. And so I always said that, you know, ever got in a position to do so, I wanted to, you know, start and to be a collector. And we, my wife and I were married in 78 as well, the first same year we bought the business. And shortly after we got married, you know, I asked her, you know, would she be interested in, and would she join me in a venture toward, you know, start looking at collecting art. And my wife has always been, you know, very supportive of me and my crazy ideas. And she said, yeah, sure, you know, tell me more about it. And so we started in 1978, 79, you know, by looking at various people, places and galleries and meeting artists, et cetera, not really knowing what we were doing. And then I finally saw it after a time that what I needed to do was to focus. And I determined after reading everything I could read that what I thought our collection should be focused on historic African American art from the 19th and 20th century. At that time, there were no, as you can probably recall, there were no places in Los Angeles where people were collecting and or displaying African American artists from the 19th and 20th century. Right. And I said, you know, this is what we should try to focus on and put together what we could describe as a, you know, premier collection of art from the period. And that's what we've researched, and that's what we tried to focus on. Shortly thereafter, you know, we start doing that. You know, I got an art consultant, so they want to be totally out of the, you know, out of my, you know, my capabilities.
Yes.
And art consultant helped us. And, you know, and I'm a read, and I read everything. I love to read about art, sure.
Sure.
I read everything anybody would put in my hands. And that's how we started collecting. You know, so we developed a list of. We developed a list of what I call our A list, our B list, you know, and our C list. And it's not that the artists were not in the quality of artists, but these are people we thought definitely you should collect. These are the ones that, you know, you should collect to come out of, and these are the ones you can wait on.
Yes.
We've always viewed it as a marathon, you know, not a sprint. We knew over time, and, you know, just something that you had to build. So we've been building it over time, and, you know, collecting based upon things we've been focused on and artists that we've looked at on and waiting and patiently waiting for those. The right thing comes about. Our criteria are that, number one, we both have to like it.
Right.
To start with. Okay, that's number one criteria. Number two, it has to be museum quality.
Yes.
Okay. And that means it has to be, you know, it has to be some of the best work that particular, you know,
yes,
has done.
Yeah.
And that's based upon research that we determine, and, you know, dealing with consultants like yourself, you know, and the work we've done to get our own eye, you know.
You know, I'm so glad you said it that way in terms of the criteria. You said what we both like. And, you know, oftentimes in my experience, I started my gallery in 88, and people would come to me for advice and apologize for basically saying, you know what, I don't know much about it. I just know what I like. And actually, that's actually a good thing. I mean, and that can evolve over time as you read more, as you see more, as you talk to artists and consultants and historians and all the rest. That can develop over time. And so that plays into the marathon aspect of it, as you're talking about, as I see it. But again, that starting point is a good starting point. And then you want the best examples from that particular artist that you can possibly get, museum quality pieces that are well curated. And I have to say, I've seen your collection, and I know you have what I consider to be one of the best African American art collections in the country. There's no question about it.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Coming for you, that makes us feel good. we started dealing with you, years ago.
Yeah, thank you. And I can remember too. You got what I consider to be one of the top Palmer Hayden paintings. That was Midnight at the Crossroads. If you don't mind me mentioning it to the audience,
but that piece, you didn't want to sell it. You remember?
Yeah, no, I know. Well, actually, what it was, I was representing the estate, and they were hesitating at the time. Yeah. They were kind of holding back, and then they decided, well, we will sell it after all. And so, I was just kind of abiding by their wishes, but that piece was autobiographical. It's so cool. I think it says a lot about the art. It says a lot about you as a collector, though, being able to hone in on that one particular piece.
Yeah, that was it. That was, she showed me a lot of Palmer Hayden. I said, no, man.
Oh, that's the one.
This is it,
And it's very personal to him, too. I mean, imagine he's growing up and, he's trying to decide what path he wants to go down. And he's memorializing it in that painting. Yeah. And it's so well executed. I can remember, too, you asked, Richard Sarr. I remember him coming in.
Yeah, Dick Sarr.
He looked at it.
He was our conservative.
Yeah, exactly. And so I remember talking to him, and he was, looking at it from a conservator's point of view, and that's always fascinating, too. I mean, he's getting down to the nitty-gritty, the way the paint is applied and so forth.
It was great to be able to work with him. One of the things I have to say is that you have to put together a team of people when you're a collector. You want a consultant, you want a conservator.
Yes.
You want the right attorney to make sure that you're getting the purchase agreement right.
And yes.
So it's not, it's an investment. You're not buying to decorate. Okay. You're buying to collect. Okay?
Exactly.
It's an investment.
And you raise very good points that every collector, I think, either deals with or should confront. And that is, like you said, it's an investment. You're putting your money in it. You want to make sure it's genuine. You want to make sure, like you said, the agreements are all tight and you're not getting yourself into any kind of trouble. And having the conservator there too. Again, it's amazing to encounter these conservators. They can look at a painting with their naked eye and see things that the average person would never be able to focus on.
Exactly.
And so that's such a good thing. And so for everybody out there that's interested in collecting, please make a note. It's good to get that team together, just like you did. Yeah. I think you set a fine example with that.
Yeah. That Palmer Hayden hangs in our sitting room, and I'm able to sit with it every day.
That makes me feel good. It's like I was talking to someone earlier today about the way a lot of artists regard their works of art as if they're children.
Yeah.
And for them, it takes on a whole, it's like a sacred object.
Yeah.
And for a collector to share that sort of same attitude and the way they look at the painting is just, it gives meaning to that phrase, the painting is in a good home. And I think that Midnight of the Crossroads.
People often say, well, what's your favorite? I said, they're all my favorite. And there's no favorite.
Exactly.
They're all children. They all like children.
Exactly. But I ask you, which one of your sons is your favorite son? How can you answer that question? That's not a fair question, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Each one, there's a story,
yes.
that goes with it.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the other thing. It's a story that goes with the painting. And or if it's a sculpture, the sculpture. I mean, I actually behind me is a Palmer Hayden painting. It's a more recent one than the Midnight at the Crossroads one.
Yeah.
And it's called The Session. And there he is. He's kind of put himself in the background. I don't know if you can tell, but he's wearing a chain around his neck. And these people have bell bottoms on and wearing big froes. So you can tell it's from the late 60s, early 70s just by looking at it. But so. He did that a lot too, by the way. He put himself in paintings in a sort of an obscure way.
Yeah.
Sometimes anyway. Yeah. But the Midnight at Crossroads, though, he's focusing on himself as a child, and that was a critical point.
Yeah, it's a great painting.
Yeah.
We're indebted to you for that, so thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm noticing, and we spoke about this a little bit earlier, but behind you is a Sam Gilliam. A lot of folks, I really appreciate the fact that you recognize the painting, value the painting. It's an abstract. A lot of people, and I respect this, But a lot of people can't really get into abstract works of art, right? And so I'm just admiring the fact that you are able to appreciate works that are not necessarily figurative.
Well, first of all, Sam Gillian was an artist we felt like we had to collect.
Yes.
Okay, he was definitely on the A-list. So it was a matter of finding the one that we would relate to. Most of the things we collect are figurative.
Yes.
You know, he was probably the first thing that was abstract that we ever collected.
Yes.
But, you know, we had the privilege of going to D.C. and actually visiting with him years ago and going to his studio and, you know, and coming out and appreciating more about him after spending the day there and coming out. And we were actually, you know, right from him. It's one of our favorite.
I'm loving it. Even just on the screen, me looking at it right now, I'm appreciating it. It's very well designed, and his use of color is really outstanding. And that's great.
And he does things at such a large scale that it's hard to find a Sam Gillian that you know you are able to put in your home.
Oh, sure.
Because they're usually the kind of scale that you have to be in a museum.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and so we usually have that. So to find something that's there was a scale that we could actually put our own, you know.
And that's an issue I've heard other collectors talk about too. That and just the sheer volume too. I know some collectors, they have more works than they can physically display, and so they have a special area. Are you in that camp? Do you have things that you have?
Yeah, we do. We have a storage unit that we use, a place where we store them.
Yeah.
Okay, and keep them at the right temperature.
Sure.
We rotate them out. You know. So it's just a privilege to be able to do that. You know.
Yes.
And it's hard to decide what you're going to move it in.
Oh, no, see, that's the thing. It goes back to that whole which one is your favorite child kind of a deal. But, physical limitations force you into making certain choices.
I put some of them in my office, so I'm able to, you know.
Spread
it
out.
Some of that spread it out a little bit, so I'm able to, you know. I went a lot of Jacob Lawrence's. We put in the office.
Yeah.
The Jacob Lawrence series on that he did on the Liberation of Haiti.
You're talking about Toussaint Louverture?
Yes, Toussaint Louverture, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, that series.
Yes.
You do get a chance to spread them out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned we can see the Sam Gillian, we talked about Palmer Hayden, you just brought up Jacob Lawrence. What are some of the other artists whose work you have in your collection?
Sure. We have Augusta Savage. We have wonderful sculpture by Augusta Savage from 1930 called A Negro Head. And we are actually able to, we have a picture of it in her studio, with her in her studio.
Oh my goodness.
I went to an exhibit at the New York Historical Society. It was an exhibit of her work, and it was a catalog, and it was the cover of the catalog.
There was that
piece hanging right there with her in her studio. That Augusta Savage is a special one for us. And it's never been touched or, you know, conserved in any manner. It's in the original form.
Oh, my goodness.
In which you did it. That one's great.
Fantastic. Is that plaster, by the way?
It is plaster.
Oh, okay.
It is plaster.
Yeah.
It is plaster.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in the same room is Elzio Cortoro.
Ah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Elzio Cortoro from the Cortoro's 1940s.
Okay.
And it's called Woman Washing Her Hair. And as he does, you know, with the heavy texture he puts in his hair. And then the elongated extremities of the subjects, et cetera. And the detail, the exquisite detail.
Oh, yeah.
He has a parrot or a bird in a cage.
Uh-huh.
See every feather of the bird.
He's a wonderful, wonderful artist. Can I tell you a quick story about Elzio Cortoro?
Sure.
So when I first opened the gallery, my first exhibiting artist was Elizabeth Catlett. And so this is 1988. And I was in a very small space on Main Street in Santa Monica. It was only 600 square feet. And I had a really small display window. And in that window, I had one of Elizabeth's lino cuts from her I Am the, what used to be Negro Woman series, but then I Am the Black Woman series. It was later retitled. And yeah. So I'm sitting in the gallery under regular hours, and there's nobody in the gallery but me, and in walks Elzer Kortor out of the blue. And he was telling me that he had to stop in because he saw Elizabeth Catlett. He and Elizabeth Catlett were friends, and he saw her print. He had to see what gallery is here showing Elizabeth Catlett's work on Main Street in Santa Monica. Coincidentally, when he came to L.A. area, one of his favorite breakfast restaurants was the Omelet Parlor, which is no longer in existence, but was down the street from my gallery. So that was my first in-person encounter, just an accidental thing with Elzer Kortor. Elzer Kortor. I feel so fortunate to have had that opportunity to talk with him.
I never had a chance to meet him. I've always wanted to meet him. That was really, would have been special.
Oh, no, absolutely, absolutely. But anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted. So besides Kortor, any other?
So something that's most recently been talked about is we have a Duncanson, the Duncanson that you saw at the inauguration.
Yes.
I'm glad to see it there. It was a loan from the museum that I'm on the board of.
Uh-huh.
But to see that Duncanson and see him recognize our Duncanson is 1865, I believe, and that one was 59, I think.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, all, you know, during around the Civil War period, you know.
You know, there's several remarkable things about that. I mean, Robert S. Duncanson, an African-American artist, at a time when, you know, slavery was still in existence, he's creating these wonderful landscapes for the most part, right. other things too. But to me, his story is just incredible. And he achieved so much at such a difficult and challenging time.
Yeah, and ours is called Canadian Landscape because at that point he had gone to Canada. You know, he had to go to Canada in order to be able to sell his work.
Yes,
and it is a wonderful landscape. You know, with a waterfall where the water actually you think the water is flowing.
Oh yeah. And so just to be clear, so you're saying that the painting, because I remember seeing the headlines about how the Biden administration put it on display. So that actually belongs to you.
No. Oh. Don't let me confuse that.
Oh,
I'm saying I'm on the board of the Smithsonian American Art Museum.
I see.
The Smithsonian American Art Museum owns the piece that Biden displayed.
I got you.
Okay. But I was since I'm vice chair of the board,
I was
a part of, you know, directing that piece over there to them.
Which
is that's what the, you know, the First Lady wanted.
Of
that's
course.
What she wanted, of course, you know.
Yeah.
We provided.
Fantastic.
Beautiful landscape with a rainbow.
Yes.
One of the hope from the rainbow represented.
Yes.
So the Wilbur Duncanson, so it's very timely, you know, artist to talk about because it was just within the inauguration.
Oh yes, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
There we have a couple of Bartes from Pasadena, Richmond Barte.
Yes.
We have Stevedore, which is a piece that he did, which represented a really strong masculine image.
Yes.
And then we also own a Ferro Bangle, which is his very light, airy dancing image.
Yes.
So they have those two Bartes and to see the spectrum in which he worked in.
Yes.
Is really quite nice.
Oh no, absolutely. He captures the movement and the physicality of those both of those figures really well.
Yeah. I don't know, you know, I could go on. I mean we got tons of people. I don't know which ones you want me to talk about. You know, we have our most recent acquisitions. Are Jacob Lawrence. Jacob Lawrence is called The Carpenters from 1944.
Uh-huh.
And it's in just exquisite condition for 1944.
Yeah.
And it has a great deal of symmetry to it where it has four images that are all working to build. And you can see him working, you know, on making sure that it all ties together in one big circle, around the work that they're doing.
Yeah.
So that's a great Jacob Lawrence. As you know, we were looking for Jacob Lawrence for some time, and we were really fortunate to find that one.
That's great.
Yeah. And then most recent acquisition is a Huey Lee Smith from 1951.
51.
It was, it comes out, also had a good provenance, one owner out of someone who was his doctor, I believe, or provided some kind of professional service for him.
Uh-huh.
He lived in Detroit. He's been in the family for a while.
So. Yeah, just for a second, I just want everybody listening and viewing to know that provenance is the history of ownership, and that's really an important element when you're buying something. It can make the difference in not just finding whether it's authentic or not, but also in determining a value. It's so funny, who owns it oftentimes can really bump up. If you take, for example, a chair, I remember a long time ago, Jackie Onassis passed away, and there was a rocking chair that if she hadn't owned it, it would probably be in the hundreds of dollars. But because she had owned it, it was worth thousands of dollars. So that's kind of an extreme example, but it does make a difference in terms of value and authentication sometimes.
Yeah, I'd absolutely underline that. You know, we look at provenance, we look at condition.
Yes.
Okay. We look at quality, the quality of the work, and obviously period that it's from. Those are all important for us.
Yes.
When we're looking at a piece.
Absolutely.
And you know, we also look at we are not spontaneous, you know, of art.
Right.
You know, in other words, we have to look at it and then we want to think about it and study it and come back and look at it.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, because therefore you have to we both have to agree on it. We both want to agree that it meets our criteria.
I just want to also bring up the fact that oftentimes, you know, it's when you say condition, you're looking for problems, but at the same time, you're looking to see whether the problems themselves had been resolved. You know, in other words, if it's been worked on, that's an important piece of information. Maybe it gets to be a question of, how much work was done to it? Because then it becomes, well, is this the work of the conservator or is this the work of the artist? And if it's an important area of the painting, it can make a difference, you know. So when you have a conservator look at it, I'm sure they're looking at that as well as just whether there's any problems with it, whether there was problems in the past and how those problems were resolved is really important.
Yeah. And we've probably had more Charles White's than anything else because Charles White's a favorite. And we know the family. So we know both his son and his daughter.
Yes.
So they are close. So we enjoy collecting.
Oh, yeah.
And the same thing is true for the SARS. I mean, you know, first of all, you know, I've known Betty for years.
Yes.
You know, Richard was our conservator. Yes. And then Allison and Leslie are clearly friends of ours, her daughters. Friends of ours, and they're both accomplished artists in their own. So we have, you know, we like to say what we call a SAR room. We have Betty and Leslie and Allison all in the same room.
You know. Oh, that's so excellent. I love that.
You know, we really, Betty, I guess, celebrated her 93rd and 94th birthday this year.
Yes.
And you know, and we were talking to her on her birthday and, you know, to wish her a happy birthday. And I said, happy birthday. And she said, well, you know, and my goal is 100, so I still got ways to go.
That's just fine. I love it. I love it. Yeah. And she's still working as far as I know.
Oh, she's definitely working.
Yeah.
You go to her studio and you see how prolific she is. And
yes.
She's obviously become very, very renowned and popular today.
Well, you know, I was really, it was funny, last year I was at the LA County Museum, they had a reception for her there, and a relatively small show, but a nice show nevertheless, that ran simultaneous to the show that was going on in New York.
Yeah, oh no, that was a beautiful exhibit.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. Absolutely.
That's what you had, the ironing board there, you know?
Yeah,
I love all those things.
Yeah.
So she's just, they're just a great family to be associated with. So we've been fortunate.
I think that's so great when you're able to communicate directly and really become friends with the artist. I mean, that takes it to another level, I think.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you can relate to it.
Yes.
Okay? And especially when you're talking about artists from this period.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
you know, because they are in their 90s if they're still around.
Yeah.
And again, when we started, they weren't being collected. You know, so we're fortunate that now they are, and they're very popular. So it's good.
Yes. Yeah.
Probably the oldest thing in our collection is the Joshua Johnson.
Oh.
From 1805, I believe it is.
Oh, my goodness. Right.
Yeah. As you know, his work is hard to find.
Very difficult.
And hard to live with. You know, you got to find the right one to live with.
Yes.
Because of the way he painted, the way he worked and painted.
Yes. You
know, large heads and small bodies. But
yes.
We're able to find a small, you know, sweet little painting. That's a painting of a young girl who we've been told, understand, was to, she had passed away, and her family must have had it done for her, because he would always put in the painting something to signify, you know, what was going on with the family, and usually flowers that the subject had passed away. And so he has a rose petal or a neck, or a rose garland, I think, around where she's holding. Somehow there are flowers in the painting.
Yeah, that's the thing. And you're right. It's so difficult to find works by him. Think about it. I mean, he's late 18th, early 19th century portrait painter for hire, basically. He hung his shingle out and produced a really nice body of work, really.
Yeah, yeah.
When you can find it. But like you said, though, it's challenging to find something that you could actually grasp and hold on to, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they're usually large, because sometimes they're family portraits.
Yeah.
They're more for museums than they are for, you know, individual collections.
Yes. Would you say that's the oldest piece you have in your collection?
I would say that is the oldest piece.
Uh-huh.
That is the oldest piece. Because I don't know of anybody that was doing work before Joshua Johnson.
That's true. I think a lot of scholars place him as the beginning, at least in terms of producing a significant body of work. I know there's names that have been thrown out there, and they've only found, like, you know, just one or two pieces here and there.
Yeah, yeah.
But his was the first, I think, that they found a significant body. Yeah, by that, I mean even a handful at that still.
Yeah.
But,
Now, what's the sculptor of your right shoulder?
Ah, so that is Meta Fuller. And it's a bronze. The interesting thing about Meta Fuller is that here she is. It's really funny. She was married to Solomon Fuller from Liberia. He was a psychiatrist. In fact, he worked with Dr. Alzheimer's of Alzheimer's fame. But he and she lived in Massachusetts, and she was producing art, and it was too expensive to make it into bronze. So mostly you find of her work, you find plaster pieces, but her namesake granddaughter, who's named Meta Fuller after her grandmother, collaborated with me, and we actually produced 6 different images, 7 bronzes per image of works that Meta wasn't able to actually do during her own lifetime, which was kind of a tragedy. Sadly, Meta Fuller, the granddaughter, actually perished in the Pentagon attack when the terrorists hit the Pentagon.
Oh my God.
And so, because we were actually planning to do more than just 6 different images. But this particular one is called Waterboy. And it was from a slave work song. It was based on a slave work song that she did this piece. It was done in 1930. And we bronzed it around 2001.
Okay.
So that's what that is. There's right. Waterboy standing, and then what's not behind me is the Waterboy bending. So she did 2 versions of it.
She's a very important artist.
Very important artist.
Very important artist.
Her most famous piece was the Ethiopia Awakening, as you already know, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And that piece, they say, actually foreshadowed the Harlem Renaissance itself. Imagine, this is 1910, 1915. She's doing this. Most scholars agree the Harlem Renaissance began around 1919. So she's using Pan-African themes before the Harlem Renaissance formally began. So I think that's pretty significant. Yeah, she's very important in the pantheon of great.
Without a doubt.
Yep.
Without a doubt. Okay.
So that's who that is back there. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. So we've got you mentioned Catlett, you know. We've got a wonderful Catlett sculpture which is a bronze did of a Gloria Van Susten. You know who that is?
She was no
Gloria Van Susten. Gloria Van Susten was a African American dancer, and Elizabeth Catlett did this cast of her head, and called it Gloria. Oh. And so, speaking of programs, this is one where the cast we have is the one that's actually owned by the Gloria.
Oh wow!
Came down from her family.
Oh, fantastic!
Yeah.
See, that's you're right to bring that up. That's such an important aspect of that particular piece. It was owned by the subject. I think that really contributes greatly to the value of it.
And this is when Catlett was living in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so she did it and cast it when she was living in Mexico.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a special Catlett.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, Elizabeth, it's funny because when I first, as I mentioned, she was my first exhibiting artist. I went down to her home in Mexico. She was sizing me up, and she wanted to. She had a bad experience with some other dealer, and she wanted to make sure she was making the right choice. And so, you know, I stayed down there for a few days. It was really very interesting. And luckily for me, at the end of that period of time, she said, "Okay, I'll do it." And that was fantastic. That's how I got started. But I just remember once. She was taking me, she and her husband took me out for dinner. And as we were driving back, we stopped at this man's place. He had a tree stump that he was giving her. And I didn't see it to its end, but I'm just imagining how she's going to transform this tree stump into some beautiful female torso. Right. It's just phenomenal to understand the before and the after when you see the raw materials and then knowing what she's going to be able to do with it. What a fantastic artist.
Yeah, it's like the Shona people. They take stone and you take a piece of stone and say the art's inside the stone.
Oh my goodness.
And they start carving it and all of a sudden they come out.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. And detail that they're able to achieve is just phenomenal.
That's absolutely amazing.
I can't even imagine doing anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I never had a chance to meet her, but I would love to.
Yeah, she's very interesting. She's a very interesting person on top of being a fabulous artist. Would you say you had more paintings than you do sculpture? Is it roughly a half? Is there any?
Yeah, I'd say more paintings than sculpture.
Yeah.
And I think there's no particular reason for that other than, in other words, we weren't staying away from sculpture. Just the artists that we were collecting probably were doing more paintings.
And probably numerically there's more painters than there are sculptors anyway, no matter what.
Yeah. I mean, for example, we have a beautiful sculpture by Marion Perkins.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But it happened because we were looking for Marion Perkins and it came along and it was perfect.
Yes.
I've been outside or whatever. So, you know, same thing is true for Sergeant Johnson. You know, we have a sculpture by Sergeant Johnson.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, yeah, we are buying to meet our goal of, you know, having the best artists but the best things that they've done.
Yes.
Period.
Yeah.
Whether they're paintings or
absolutely. I really appreciate and admire that.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, do you collect any works by, say, the sort of what you might call the young contemporary artists that are out there now, or do you just cut it off at a certain point?
Yeah, you know, we don't. We have Chaz Gass.
That's
probably the most youngest artist in our collection. Chaz is a great artist and a friend of ours.
Yes.
We've stayed in our lane, in the 18th and 19th century. I mean, you can be all over the place with art.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what I know, and I know what I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I've not tried to get into collecting a lot of the more contemporary artists who I love, by the way.
Yeah.
But I don't know as much about them and I haven't studied them. And so I try to stay with what I know.
I think that's actually a very good strategy. As you say, you can kind of focus. And I think by focusing, you end up learning more and delving more and be in a better position to to get, like you mentioning before, the better examples of that particular artist. One way you, yeah. you can figure that yeah. out is by just spending more time focusing on those different artists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for me at least, I and again, like you, I mean, I appreciate it all. But you know, you do focus on certain things. But I just admire the artists from the past because of so much. I mean, the modern artists have a lot to deal with too. Not to take anything away, but just imagine. Like you were talking about growing up in the Jim Crow era, confronted with colored-only signs. And, yeah. and I know just growing up as a kid, too, you know, you had to worry about the Ku Klux Klan, even though nowadays it looks like we still have to worry about the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
then, you know, it was a different time. I mean, it was almost an accepted policy to exclude blacks, especially in the arts.
Yeah.
That's a phenomenal thing. I know that when Bearden and Henderson wrote that book about African-American art, to get in the book, you had to have been born before 1925.
Yeah.
And the reason being, it was so much more challenging for those artists to develop. And it just proves not only their tenacity, but that passion they had, that fire in the belly to do. I remember one artist, for example, I talked to, he said, when he was asked, why do you paint? And he said, because I have to. And I think that kind of drive is what drove them to go against like Joshua Johnston, Robert S. Duncanson, even Charles White and all those artists. They had to deal with so much.
Yeah. And Archibald Mosley, for example, drove him as well.
Yeah.
Well, this has been great.
Yeah, it's been fabulous. So Bob, if somebody were to ask your advice about collecting, what would you tell them?
Well, I've given a lot of those nuggets, I think, today. First of all, only collect what you love.
Yeah.
Number two, research what you're going to collect before you collect it. Understand what you're collecting. Don't buy emotionally, but determine in advance, you know, even after you identify it. Groundwork on it. When you find what you want to collect, make sure you understand about its condition, its provenance. We talked about earlier, and it's authenticity, of course.
Yeah.
And then to make sure you have, you know, you get adequate transfer title. You know. So it's clear that. You know, you own it. Once.
That's a good point. And we didn't speak too much about that before, but that's a very good point about title. And that's the thing, because what you want to make sure is that piece doesn't have any kind of encumbrances. It's not been pledged as collateral for debts and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
And the person that owns it does actually own it.
Exactly.
I remember once being... I thought I had won this by auction online, a wonderful Buford Delaney, only to find out that the Delaney was actually owned by somebody else other than the person that was selling it. And it was an interesting experience, but it illustrates how important it is, like you said, about title. So
yeah,
everybody, please keep that in mind.
Exactly.
And the actual sales agreement should have something addressing that. And there's other ways, too, to make sure you're covered.
Exactly.
And one last question before we go. Anything on the horizon, I mean, in terms of your collecting or, for that matter, some of your philanthropic activities, anything you care to share with us before we go?
Well, I'll give you just a teaser that – I told you I'm on the collection committee at the Smithsonian African American Museum, and we're about to make a major acquisition, which I think is going to make everyone quite thrilled and happy in the area of historic African American photography.
Fantastic.
And I'm also on the collection committee at the Huntington Library,
and
there's going to be a great show opening up called Made in LA, which is a collaboration with the Hammer Museum in LA, and they're all artists from Los Angeles that displayed in this exhibit.
Oh, fantastic. How soon will that occur?
Well, it's been hanging since last fall, waiting for the county to give a green light to bring people in.
Oh, sure.
So I expect it's going to open as soon as the county says people can go to the museum. But it's a great exhibit. I have a catalog. I haven't seen it myself. Hope to see it in the next 4 months out.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to definitely look forward to it. I'm sure everybody listening and viewing will do the same.
It'll be a collaboration between, as I said, between the Hammer and Hunter Library. So you'll artists in both places.
And you said there's a catalog as well.
There is. There is a catalog that exists right now.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
You can probably get it at the Hunter Library online or Amazon on Made in LA.
Okay. Because one of the things I collect is catalogs and books. Because,
okay.
So I know for me personally, I'm going to pursue that for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Bob Davidson, thank you so much. You've very graciously shared your time and your experiences, and I really can't thank you enough. And thank you for sharing your perspective. And for everybody out there, thank you for tuning in. And don't forget to subscribe. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity and the pleasure.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob.